This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me, as usual, is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
This week, we have five main releases to talk about. We're going to kick off with Marco Zorro in Fist of the Condor. Then we have A Woman Under Siege in No One Will Save You. And then it's off for a bit of supernatural shindigs in The Haunting of Queen Mary. It's the end of school with End of Term, and then a historic biopic, Washington Armor. Our short shot is Lollipop, and we're going to wind up with our DTV throwback, Ballistic. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first film then is Fist of the Condor. A lone warrior is on a quest to find his twin brother after he had murdered his Sifu and stolen the secret training manual for the Fist of the Condor. So, Rich, Marco Zorro is still something of an unsung action hero, I think. He's made quite a few films, you know, where he's had starring roles in films like Kiltro, Mandrill, and what's the third one called?
There was one called Mirage Man. There's Mirage Redeemer. Man.
That's right. Mirage Man is the one I'm thinking of. I've only seen Kiltro out of those, unfortunately. I haven't caught up with others.
I think Kiltro is the only one that's had a UK release.
I think it is. I think you might be right. Yeah, I think the other two have been released in the States. But he's also very well known as a henchman. He was the main bad guy in Undefeated 3. Against Scott Atkins with his chocolate. He's also very memorable in the recent John Wick 4 as the sort of very mendacious henchman who eventually gets done in by the dog. But he's really, really good in that as well. So it's really great to sort of see him in a starring role here, in fact, in two starring roles here, as our main character and the sort of enigmatic twin brother that we pop in to see every now and again. It's probably no secret, Rich, that I absolutely love this. It is the classic sort of martial arts formula, lots of sort of training sequences, lots of great fights and everything. And it's, you know, there is this sort of open-ended element. We never get to the sort of the big duel between brother and brother, which probably makes sense because they're the same person. But that doesn't mean we don't get a great fight at the end with an absolute killer of a finishing move. I shall talk more about this in a minute, but over to you, Rich.
Yeah, it is very much, you know, it's paying tribute to those 1970s, you know, Hong Kong, you know, martial arts, Shaw Brothers, all that sort of stuff. You know, no cliche is left unturned. In its own way, this is their version of Kill Bill, right down to the chapter breaks and the open ended. I mean, it even starts. It says it's like part one or whatever at the start in the opening titles. You know, from the start that it's of the first volume or whatever it is you're going to consider it as, although they're not putting that on the cover or the poster or the listing or anything, but it does say on film that this is an incomplete project. Now, I've heard that it was originally a web series, or it was conceived as a web series, and I had that in mind when I was watching it, and it really did help make sense of it because it's very episodic. It's literally, you could imagine that as like, here's a 10-minute short film, here's the next 10-minute short film, you know, and you could watch them that way. You could watch it that way quite easily. You could just finish one, have a pause or whatever, and you could digest it that way or watch the whole thing in one go. It's they call it chapters, don't they? Yeah. I think it's about, there's like about what, six or something?
Six came to mind, yeah.
And every one of them sort of delves in a bit deeper. It's aesthetically, it's all, it's in terms of, like I said, leaning into the real martial arts cliches. It's got, fast paced, really intense, well choreographed action, but it's also a very and fantastical action as well. There's definitely, it's say in the old style, it's the superhuman abilities kind of thing, and this comes into play later when he's got to train to not use his legs and try and jump over these vaults and stuff like that. And there's a there's a master who's training them, and it's all this sort of a, not Pai Mei because it's a bit much nicer, but there's that master apprentice kind of thing going on. And like we said, there's the twin brothers, and there's the jealousy, there's the book. We were talking about Wrath, completely different kind of film, Wrath of Dracula, and how all these moves were in this book, this sacred book kind of thing. And that's what this film is about. That's the MacGuffin essentially of the film, is they're trying to get this book, which has instruction, the instructions of this
very
this
deadly
art,
martial art.
yeah, deadly martial art, the Fist of the Condor, that is only known to a chosen few. And so they're bad, sort of, that's the motivating sort of factor. And then there's revenge about the, the death of a master and all that sort of stuff. Everything's in there. It's but done fantastically well. It's showing you everything you've seen before. I mean, if the Chilean angle, is a slight novelty, but it doesn't, it's not, you don't really think about that. It's very much of its own thing. And also, you feel like it's a historic kind of piece because of all the
Very
open
anachronistic.
landscapes and buts. But every now and again, they'll put you in an environment and say, no, this is happening now. It's like, it feels very historic, but it's like, no, he's gonna, he's gonna walk into a bar and all this sort of stuff. And so we get sort of contemporary kind of action scenes as well as the sort of more historic stuff and sort of poetic sort of musings and stuff, the sort of the narration, because Marco Zorro himself as the characters, he doesn't really have any dialogue. He doesn't really talk. He's very stoic. A lot of the time he's actually on his own, so he's not really inclined to, to talk or anything. So we get this inner monologue. Now, what I thought was quite interesting is there's this there's this theme of duality that runs through the whole thing, one of them being the twins thing, but then there's also so that's the very literal side, but then there's the duality of each individual character. And also you sometimes get a bit uncertain about who actually is in a scene, who you're following. So are you watching that brother, the good brother, or good brother or bad brother? And there's little sleights of hand sort of thing is how I took it anyway.
No, you're absolutely right, Rich. That there is that there's a very enigmatic quality towards the who it is we're actually with, who are we actually sympathizing with for a lot of this film, because are we following the chosen brother who was chosen by the Sifu to actually learn the Fist of the Condor and do all this hard training, or is it his brother who is rejected but yet sort of hides in the background and secretly trains and then gets caught out? And
And
because
he's
there's a
like,
line
and
where
at
he
one
sort of
point they
says,
say, oh, and who are you really
"Who are you
training? And
exactly?
she's
Who are
like,
you actually?"
ah,
Yeah, exactly.
that's
There
something
is
for you to
that.
ponder.
And even that the let's call them the evil twins, henchman, is like, "Are you the same person?" Even he's not entirely sure himself. What's going on? But I think his deeds do speak for themselves. Certain things that happen towards the end of the film, which kind of sort of point you in one direction at least, or but even then it could be Fight Club all over again. It could be Tyler Durden and the unknown guy, but who knows. But even so, I think this is, it is one of the most poetic martial arts films I've seen, I think.
But completely accessible. It's not like up its own what's it or whatever.
It's no, not at all.
It walks that fine line You know, it knows to when to, you know, deliver the sort of more thought-provoking stuff and when to actually say, right, we're going to cut to the action now. So you get every let's say every episode, you get a big set piece.
Absolutely. And there's some great love vibes on this.
Yeah. And you don't have to wait long between the two. And you just sort of go along with it and you can sort of take the ride and take as much out of it as you want. You could watch it for, you can really absorb all that sort of spiritual side of it, or you can just watch it as a very straightforward kind of revenge tale. It's really however you want to take it, but you're going to enjoy it either way, I think.
Oh, yeah.
If you're a martial arts movie fan.
And Marco Zarora himself, you know, I don't think I've ever seen him look so, well, you know, so powerful in a film. You know, it's just, he comes across as just a pure martial artist in this, you know, and the actual art they've made up for the film, you know, in the grand tradition of, you know, they're not sort of Snake in the Eagle Shadow and this sort of stuff, you know, where they sort of basing an art on the movements of an animal kind of thing.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah, you know, we got this great, you know, all this swooping arms and everything. I think it looks superb, you know, and those punches that he does are absolutely great. That
well, it's like in that bar scene when he, you know, he does like the 1-inch punch kind of thing, and the guy just flies across the room.
Yeah, I love all that. Brilliant. And as I said, that end fight was superb. And the music.
You've got to think, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, Marco Zarora, we know of him, but, you know, after his. You know, we've sort of been familiar with, like, Kiltro when that came out and stuff like that. But and through the Scott Adkins films,
well, that's
and,
it.
Working with Robert Kiltro. Rodriguez,
yeah,
and John Wick, but he's still basically an unknown. And he's and this is, you know, he's been around for well over 15 years.
Yeah,
and it's crazy that this is like one of what, two films that had a UK release.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It's interesting sort of to compare him now to what he was like in Kiltro as well, because in Kiltro, his character is like this kind of this sort of lumbering oaf kind of thing who needs to be sort of, you know, he's like a lump of clay that needs to be sort of modeled. Here we've got the model, you know, which is even further refined as the film goes on. But he's superb in this. I thought, you know, as
and both. He's working with. Sorry.
No, come on.
As is, sorry, you're saying?
No, carry on.
Oh, sorry, I accidentally cut you off there. No, I was going to say the director, Ernesto Diaz Espinosa, he is the same director who Zarora has been working with since Mirage Man and Kiltro and Mandrill. They also did Redeemer, which I think you see on a lot of this. I haven't seen Redeemer, but, you know, you look at the trailer and stuff and you read about it, and you can see that is the kind of thing that Zarora is really interested in, sort of the spiritual side as well as the sort of hard-hitting action. And that's what you get. That's what they've developed with this. Earlier films, like, say, Mandrill was like a James Bondish sort of fun kind of adventure. And I think Mirage Man was a superhero movie. So they've toyed in different genres. But I think Zarora is quite a... He seems like quite a guy who, you know, he's very focused. I feel like he's like his character in this, that he's someone who's got a lot, you know, he's very stern, you know, very focused, but, you know, he's got a lot going on. He's a kind of guy. And we often don't get to see much of that, but we get to see a bit more of it now through, like, say, it's expressed through the, through his narration. You know, through the way he's articulating himself. And again, that's another sort of a duality kind of thing, because he's like keeping all of that hidden, but he's sharing that with, you know, who's he talking to? He's talking to the audience. He's sharing it. It's like his inner monologue, and he's sharing it with the audience. Whereas otherwise he's not talking. He's probably, I think he's got like a family, and he's, you know, he probably doesn't really share that side of himself with them. And or is that the brother? I get confused.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Which one's which? So, I did like it a lot. I wasn't sure, because it's one of those films that comes with a lot of hype, you know, expectation. So I was a little hesitant to actually watch it, because I was worried I wasn't going to enjoy it as much as, you know, the internet was telling me I was going to. But, I mean, we got some really good... I just want to mention some of the supporting players in the film. So we got Jose Manuel, who's a great. I think he's Portuguese. We've seen him in a few. Well, we've definitely watched him in the short film by Bobby Samuels, which was Jogando do. I'm gonna mess up the title. Con Fuego, which
Oh,
was
yeah.
the one where the American agent goes to. It's like a 40-minute film. We covered it a few weeks ago. You can find it on YouTube, and he has a great like knife fight with I think it's him and another character. So it's like there's 2-on-1 kind of thing. Really, really good fight scene. But he also did a film called The Man from Kathmandu, where he's actually the lead in that. It's a Nepalese film. He's cast as Nepalese or half Nepalese, but that's a another film that's not really available. It's not available in the UK, but he and that was from a couple of years ago. But I think that's his only leading feature role. But there's some fantastic stuff in that. I mean, he's a very Jackie Chan influenced kind of guy, so definitely well worth checking out some of his stuff. But the other people in this that he fights, like the henchman, as it were, who he has the climactic showdown with. I wasn't familiar with him or really many of the others. So it's great to always sort of discover new people as well as sort of seeing someone you're familiar with, like say Marco Zorro, and seeing him and Jose Manuel well fight is great, but the other fights were really good. You know, there wasn't a poor fight scene in the whole film,
No,
you know.
not at
So it's
all.
like
It's very good.
you get your money's worth, definitely.
Speaking of cast members, Gina Aguad, who plays the Sifu, Mujer Condor, is actually Marco Zorro's mum.
Is
Yeah.
it? She was great, though. She was
She was
really
very
good.
good in that. Yeah, very good. Okay, scores on the doors, Rich.
I'm gonna say a. Got to be an 8, isn't it? I think.
It does. I was going to give it a 9, but I am going to have to dock it a point just for the title cards. I will give it credit though, because at least people actually say the words. So whatever the title's called actually comes up in the dialogue for that thing. So okay, so make a drinking game out of it or something.
Well, that's what
But
I'm saying. We kind of got to let that slide because I think it's because of the I'm
yeah,
pretty sure
I
it's because it
guess.
was a web series, which backs up the sort of budgetary kind of look of it. It does look and feel more like it was a lower budget, but still slick looking, but
Oh,
sort
it
of a
looks
lower
very sick.
budget.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah,
I love
sort of.
all the stuff filmed on the coast and everything.
Yeah,
I
exactly.
thought that was
Yeah.
all great. The music as well. It's a mix of different genres, but there's a very heavy sort of like South American folk influence to it, which I really got into, I must admit. So yeah, it's a very high 8 for me. So it's 2 8s for Fist of the Condor.
So I'm just asking one other thing, because and the other sort of films that came to mind of the similar sort of era was like Kung Fu, David Carradine kind of stuff. But the Silent Flute came to mind as I was watching
Indeed.
it.
Yep.
Do you think that's because I haven't seen the Silent Flute for a long time, and I was
Oh, a
couldn't
long
remember
time
whether
ago, yeah.
is that
I
again
think
in
you're
the
right,
same
yeah.
kind of wheelhouse
I think you're
sort
right,
of.
because it is that sort of quest, to get back to sort of fighting David Carradine's character, isn't it? I think, so there is definitely that element. There is a sort of spiritual element to it.
And it all goes back to Bruce Lee, obviously. So
Indeed, yeah.
this is, I think, so he doesn't. I don't know if there's any name checks or it, because a lot of these kind of films, they'll add a name check somewhere, but I can't remember if there's actually
Never noticed any this time around,
a name
no.
check for Bruce Lee. But I think Bruce Lee's influence is tangible over the whole film. I mean, as he is over the entire martial arts film genre.
Yeah, totally agree. Anyway, there we have it. 2 8s for Fist of the Condor. Go check it out. Our next film is No One Will Save You. Bryn Adams lives a solitary existence in her house in the middle of a forest. One night, she discovers to her horror that someone or something has broken in and is roaming around downstairs. So, this is a film which has recently hit Hulu in the States and Disney in the UK. Comes with a lot of excitable word of mouth, Rich, which has sort of like pushed us towards checking it out.
Yes.
I did like this, not probably as much as some people do, from, you know, judging by the way people have reacted to it. It does have a few novel ideas in that, you know, there is very little dialogue in the film. I think there's only about two, maybe three lines, which are sort of, you know, rushed through. But the rest of it is just noise and ambient sort of sound effects and things. It doesn't play its cards that close to its chest. It is very open about what's going on very quickly. You know, as soon as it turns to nighttime, we're very aware what is going on, kind of. You know, it's not coy about who the threat is or anything. It's like right there in your face. And it sort of develops from there. It also handles exposition very well. I don't know about you, but I was, because of the backstory to do with Bryn and her friend Maud and that relationship there, I was really expecting, literally expecting, right, any second now, especially as the film went on, there's going to be a newspaper clipping or something, you know, that's going to flutter in front of the camera, and we're going to know finally what happened way back when, you know. But it handles it in a different way, which was kind of cool and quite nasty as well, actually, when you find out what actually happened. But there you go. Your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, it's funny you say about the exposition, because I kind of think about that. It's almost a film without exposition, and it doesn't take any of those cheap tricks of, you know, a montage of newspaper clippings, as you say.
There's no news reports telling us
no
what's
news
going
reports
on
or anything. Yeah, there's nothing like that. I think I knew going. I'm gonna preface this saying this is a film that's best to know very as little about as possible before you go in. So I would say skip over if you're planning on seeing it, you just want to go in completely blind. We're not going to go into like proper spoilers, but anything, you know,
and skip IMDb.
trying to avoid any chatter about it. That's the problem with some of these things. You've got to avoid, you know, being on social media and everything. But so I already knew that there wasn't going to be really any dialogue. So that sort of piqued my interest. Because I'd seen it come up, and I was a bit unsure about it, but I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. It's been done before; we've seen it a couple of times.
Oh, I remember there was there's A Quiet Place and things like that as well. But I mean, the reasons are different. You know, it's not because they have to be quiet, otherwise the aliens are going to get them. You know, but it's
that's the thing. It is a conceit, essentially, because although it is a one person alone kind of thing, I don't know how much dialogue there was in stuff like The Shallows, for example, of, you know, the character maybe shouting at sharks or whatever it is. But this is a character who's very internal, doesn't, a movie would normally maybe have the character walking around the house talking to themselves, or, oh, they've got a dog and they'll talk to the dog, or they'll talk to the mirror or whatever they'll do. And she doesn't say a word. And, you know, and they don't make an excuse for it, like she's a mute or something like that. I'm quite interested to see what they do with this John Woo film, Silent Night, how they handle that, because that's going to be a very different kind of thing. How are you not going to have any dialogue in a situation like that? So this one is, you know, she's living on her own, it's isolated, so for the most part she doesn't have any reason to talk to anyone. In a normal kind of situation, they'd be shouting at the, you know, the threat or whatever, you know. But here they don't lean on that. They're just very much focused. And you don't think about it after a while. It becomes very natural. It sort of eases. Now, when she goes into an environment where there's more people, I think it's harder to sell that, because it becomes then very obvious that they're trying not to have dialogue, when really there would be. I mean, there's some muffled kind of stuff. They muffle sort of sound in the background. But then you get a couple of encounters where it just feels like there would be something said, and they're sort of the movie is biting its lip to try not to, because they want to hold out for to have more impact when particular words are spoken and stuff. So, but I think for the most part, it works really well, and you are very driven and drawn by the, you know, the visual and, say, auditory. You know, there's no dialogue, but it's not, you know, it's one of those things where you say a silent film, but it's not a silent film. You know, in the old days, silent films still had a score. Nowadays, you wouldn't call this a silent film because the sound design is too complex. So it's just a film with minimal dialogue, I would say, but there's everything else going on. Fantastic score and
Absolutely.
all this sort of stuff. It's very, the first thing that struck me is it just looks amazing. The cinematography is really striking. You know, every shot is composed beautifully. I will say, an excellent tension. I didn't know going in that it was going to be such a horror film, which it is for the most part. I think it's very much, you know, it leans into the horror genre probably more than any. But I will say that the sort of the Steven Spielberg influences are very apparent, as well as other things. I mean, another before I saw it, another comparison that people have made was Signs, which I think is very warranted. Say specifically, they were referring to like the final act of Signs. So there are Signs similarities, but the sort of Spielberg in even that film was like a Spielberg influence. So the Spielberg influence is sort of through that. You know, there's films like Close Encounters and War of the Worlds are in there, but also the Spielberg influence stuff like Super 8. I think Super 8 would fit really nicely with this. They all do similar thing, which was another film which really lent into horror quite a lot, but then also had this quite heartfelt stuff going on as well, which is also a part of this film, which is, again, is a Spielberg kind of thing to do. The This is written and directed by Brian Duffield, by the way, who is a writer, foremost the screenwriter, did films like Love and Monsters,
I'm a big fan of,
Underwater, the two babysitter movies, which we saw the first one liked, and he did his previous film that he directed was one I've been quite interested to see. It's called Spontaneous. It's like a love story about people spontaneously combusting or something. It was a strange sort of comedy, romance, kind of horror kind of thing. Yeah, and Love and Monsters was supposed to be really good as well. And he
It
also
is.
worked on or developed the Skull Island animated. I think it's an animated series on Netflix. Our lead actress, should mention her because she carries the film. You know, Caitlin Dever, as Bryn, very interesting, engaging character, great performance. You know, she's got a lot to do. You know, say the film is on her shoulders. I think in the second half of the movie, I lost it a bit. I lost my enthusiasm a bit. It does go very, very CGI, perhaps a bit too much for my liking, and it becomes a bit more complex, let's say, as the conclusion draws. And so I think I really enjoyed the sort of first half of the movie the most. Same without sort of giving anything away. The sort of, I'd say the first half is more sort of pure horror and tension kind of part. Then we get into more of a blockbuster kind of sort of bang crash kind of section. And then the third, and then the final part is sort of goes in sort of different directions that I
Very
won't spoil. But
enigmatic ending, I think. Very
yeah,
interesting.
there's different things to sort of unpack about it, and it's presented in a very, very unique way. It's basically, you're not going to see it coming. It's like the way this film ends, you're just not gonna, it's you're not going to see it coming. I'll just say that much. But
Absolutely.
yeah, so how were you, what were your thoughts on the film? How
I
did you
thought
like it?
it was okay. I did enjoy it. I was kind of surprised at the level of budget it had. A lot of these films, it's all about the lighting, all the spooky lights outside, that sort of thing, and keeping things as as coy as possible as to what's really going on. We'll keep the threat out of sight, as much as possible. This one, it's like, nah, there you go, mate. And if you like that one, there's more coming. There's all different shapes and sizes of things sort of coming at you.
I will say the threat is very classic. You know, they've not gone for anything. They've gone for a real particular. I think there's a touchstone of like the 1950s or something in this because they're you know, the look, the threat and the things, you know, around. It's a very
It's a very
on the
classical
nose
sort
kind of
of
classic, yeah, presentation of that particular, you know, everything's in there. It's like, without going into it too much, but all the familiar tropes you will recognize, you're like, oh yeah, it's that bit that
I was wondering though, when she sort of like, there's an incident early on with a clock tower, shall we say, and I was wondering whether or not it was all some sort of psychotic break on her part, and that she was interpreting things as being what it is, but in fact she's just like killed a bunch of people. You know, it's like, oh sorry. But that was just me.
I think they could have gone there, and I think even towards the end that could be that could, you know, it,
because there was that look of surprise, you know, there's like, oh, why have you done this sort of thing, you know, a couple of times, because, you know, it's not just one. I think she kills about, you know, quite a few in the end, but I can just sort of imagine them sort of, you know, especially because we, you know, we can't understand what's being said. And I was wondering if they're eventually going to be able to interpret what was actually being said, and it's going to turn out to be, oh, you know, you just killed Jerry or whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's it's interesting. I think you could potentially even read read it that way. I think, you know, there's different ways you can go at it, but you know, we were talking in the previous film about duality, and that's present in here as well. There's a really interesting thing they do where you're following the main character, Bryn, and, you know, it's the classic thing of there's something behind her. You know, it's blurred away and it's in the distance, but you can just about see something. And they play that typically, you know, that kind of typical scene, but then they flip it. They do it the other way.
Yeah,
we follow the threat, and then she becomes the thing in the background, which I thought was really interesting. And then there's other things with duality where she sort of encounters another version of herself. You know, there's some dream stuff and different things happening. So yeah, there's something about you know, she's trying to confront herself. You know, because, say, she's carrying a lot of baggage. It's a film about her trying, you know, her journey to overcome trauma, which is sort of that's the kind of the heart of the film, of, you know, the journey that she's supposed to be taking over the course of the film, not just battling the threat and being a very resilient heroine, but actually, you know, overcoming her own sort of baggage. You know, that's like, you know, we don't, like you say, there's no real, it takes a long time for the, you know, for things to become clear as to why she is, you know, living such an isolated life, and why people react to her in a certain way when she's, you know, when she comes into company and stuff. So, I think for the most part, I think it does work. I think you know, some people will be very thrown, as I was a bit thrown, by the final act. But I definitely think it's worth seeing. It is really worth seeing. It's probably one of those films that's going to reward a rewatch, you know, and then you can sort of delve into things a bit more rather than, but I think some people would just go, wow, you know, I'm completely taken with it straight away. And other people will be going like, okay, yep. Okay, I was with you for most of it, and I'm just a bit. Can I just put my hand up and ask a question, kind of thing? But so I mean, it was really a pleasant surprise. I've never heard of it. I didn't know anything about it. It popped up. I saw people talking about it. I gave it a shot. It you know, the fact that all the buzz was attached to it, I thought it lived up to the buzz, and, you know, it had enough surprises that you know, made it a novel experience. But it, I think it's how. Is there anything? I don't think I've got anything more to say on it. Have you?
I like the bit on the bus as well. The bus sequence was really good.
Yeah, that was really cool. That was another one of those sort of, you know, War of the Worlds, I would say. War of the Worlds kind of.
It was interesting as well, because it's one of those elements where you've got a protagonist who's thinking rationally, It's like this freaky shit going on in my house. I'm getting the fuck out of here. I'm just ditching this place and leaving town. Obviously that would be a short film if that if she was able to do that. But
Well, it's another film that actually I want to mention as a sort of a film that you could watch this with, which works with some similar themes, which is Nope, which I didn't
Right.
really get on with. I didn't think it was, I didn't, I wasn't quite with it, but
Still
it
haven't
does
seen it.
touch on some similar. Have you seen it yet?
No, not yet.
It's very different to this,
Yeah.
but there are certain elements, and in that case, it's kind of the whole thing about Nope is just like, you see, you're in this kind of situation, Nope. It's like, I'm going, kind of thing. But and in that case, they can't actually extract themselves from the situation. But that's characters in a very isolated setting, dealing with this thing, and it's got, it's sci-fi, it's horror. There's a bit of comical stuff in there. This hasn't really got any comedy. It's got some fantastical stuff in it. But yeah, I think the yeah, I think people who enjoyed Nope would probably find this quite involving, quite interesting, I think. There's another franchise that this very much is based on, but again, I don't want to mention it because the
I
not
think we already
franchise, but
did.
series.
Yeah,
Sorry?
we already did.
Did we?
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Oh.
Yeah, but anyway, I totally agree. How are you going to score it?
I think I'm going to give it an 8, actually. Yeah, for although I've got some reservations about some of it, I think so much of it works really well that I have to give it an 8.
I'm giving it a 7. So there you go. That is an 8 and a 7 for No One Will Save You. It's available on Hulu in the States and it's on Disney Plus here in the UK. Go check it out. Our next film is The Haunting of the Queen Mary. This explores the mysterious and violent events surrounding one family's voyage on Halloween night in 1938 and their interwoven destiny with another family on board the famous ocean liner in present day. I think this is a case, Rich, where they had access to a brilliant location, but didn't really know what to do with it. So just threw everything they had written down at it. I don't know. The pacing, the atmosphere is dull. There are,
Oh.
yeah, sorry. There are moments where things happen. There's some good gory moments, admittedly. There's a whole really mean-spirited bit to do with the sun, which I honestly thought, like, well, wow, they've done that, before. It turns out they haven't. But that was interesting. But overall, I just found it just a bit dull overall. How about you?
I was blown away by it. I thought it was one of the most visually striking films I've seen in age. I wasn't sure what it was. I thought it was going to be like Titanic 2 going in. I was expecting something really low budget, and this is lavish. It's got. I was also put off by the because I was thinking, oh, it's 2 plus hours. It's 2 hours 5 minutes long. I was like, that's really long. That's really unusual for a film. For a DTV film to be that long. This is a film that I think really deserves to be seen in the cinema because it just looks fantastic. It's a bit like what we were saying about a couple of about like the previous film. It's like fantastically composed shots. It and some nice visual effects as well. The although derivative, it's kind of stuff we've seen before, a bit like whether it's Titanic or Poseidon kind of thing, but sweeping shots, and we see the ship and it doesn't look rubbish. The exteriors of the
No,
ship when they
yeah.
show it looks really good. The parallel narratives cutting between 1938 and the present, or is it, is it actually happen is it actually something that happened in 1938 but it's actually happening now? It's like in the sort of spirit world, as it were, kind of thing. We're not quite sure. It's all, open to interpretation what's happening, because there's very fantastical stuff happening in that particular version or the story. So whether that's an ongoing nightmare thing. So, you know what it reminded me of? I haven't seen Triangle, but the one it re but it really reminded me of, there was an X-Files episode where Mulder and Scully were, I think they were on a ship in the Bermuda Triangle, and that was a sort of time travel
All right.
sort of thing. And so I was kind of reminded of that. And so I think the film Triangle, the Christopher Smith film, was set on a boat. I think it might
It
have done a,
was, yep.
was it a
It
ship?
was.
Was it a
Yes, it
ship?
was. Yeah, it was
Yeah.
like a cruise liner sort of thing, yeah.
Cruise liner kind of thing. But I think the film that this most is channeling, a bit like, let's say, the previous film was channeling a bit of, you know, quite a heavy Steven Spielberg influence. I think The Shining
Shining,
is kind of all over this.
yeah.
There's a lot of like scenes that are, or
Even
shots.
down to the snazzy carpets.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. I was going to say, like the hallways and, you know, the thing with children, you know, the little boy going around, which is really unexpected casting because what's the is the boy's name's Lenny. He's actually from Essex, and he played Tiny Tim in a recent version of Christmas Carol, and he's got, I believe he's got the same condition as Warwick Davis, so he looks very young. He's very small,
Yeah.
but he's about 8 years old, and so he that sort of plays into the story with the with his mother, who's played by Alice Eve, and so she's very concerned about his health and stuff, but really she's not. You think she's kind of says she is and
Oh,
stuff,
there's a whole bit, the whole bit at the beginning
hmm.
where, there's stuff happening to him
Yeah.
and she's just like blithely totally unaware of it.
Yeah, they're complete.
What?
Well,
Oh,
both of them are,
yeah.
you know, both of them seem to be completely oblivious, and that's really odd in certain points. Like for example, something happens to him, you don't know what's happened, and then all of a sudden you see him again, and he's all like wet and stuff. But they're barely paying any attention to
I
him,
know,
and
yeah.
there's something. But whether that's them or the ship's influence, because this is the thing that's the sort of the evil of the ship or whatever it is. Which eventually comes out. There's some stuff. It gets into the characters, and so it starts affecting the way they behave, and you know they forget, which is what happened. It happens quite suddenly, actually, in the, with the with the with the flashback story. I'll say with the
Yeah.
1938 events. It's like things are going one way, and then all of a sudden, it's like. But I do agree with what you were saying about, you know, they kind of throw lots at it. Because there's lots of different stuff happening, and it's all going all over the place. So we've got the parallel narrative, we've got the parents in the past, parents in the present. We've got some side characters that we're following. We've got the stuff going on in the boiler room, and I think it is, and that's where the 2 hours comes from, because there's just so much they're trying to pack in. And no, it doesn't all work necessarily. But I think a bit like with No One Will Save You, I think enough of it worked for me. I mean, I was just completely transfixed by it for the most part. I actually prefer it to No One Will Save You, probably because it does have that kind of consistency. It doesn't have any sort of more, yeah, it kind of stays its course, as it were. You know, you kind of know where you stand. But you do get a bit lost with kind of like, I think it tries to be. It might maybe it's trying to be a bit too clever, and it just loses the audience a bit, because you're like, well, I'll be honest, I don't know what you're doing here. What's happening with this bit? But I can see the general sense of it is, it's like the Here's Johnny kind of thing. It's you know, the I mean,
It's got
there's a bar scene where that makes you think of The Shining and stuff, and I think it's all these characters, these particular characters, the sort of the sanity. You know, they start to lose their sanity, and that's what we see in the past with the parallels. There's the captain of the past, and then there's this guy who calls himself a captain, but he's essentially supposed to refer to as
It's just
basically a
a
security
security
guard.
guard, yeah.
And because the ship is, you know, static, it's a tourist attraction. It's Queen Mary, and it's in the
Yeah,
United States. That
it's
is
in
where they
Los
filmed.
Angeles, isn't it?
Yeah, I think actually, I'm not
It's a
sure how much
hotel.
they filmed it there. Because I think they filmed it in various places, and I saw HMS Belfast, which is
All right.
in London.
Yeah.
I saw that on the end credits, so I'm wondering if that's where they shot some of the boiler room scenes and stuff,
Yeah,
because our that's
probably.
got a very, you know, big accessible kind of
Certainly,
space
you
there.
certainly wouldn't be shooting the ballroom scene there, no.
No, no, but you got the, I mean, production value here in terms
Oh,
of the
there's loads,
cinematography, the
yeah.
production design. It's fantastic. I'm really surprised to see a film of this standard, not getting a cinema release. I mean, you do, it does happen. Obviously, we see it all the time. But I would have thought, I would have been more unsurprised if I saw this as a Netflix original, or an Amazon Prime, because that's kind of what I expect. But when you get something like this just going VOD, so it's not really got any sort of natural, marketing kind of push. It does. It's not going to appear on anyone's log. No one's going to log in and see it and then start watching it or whatever. Even without any big marketing, that still puts it in front of people's faces or whatever. This is still a film that people is going to struggle, I think, because the title and the cover and the title and everything is actually really generic, and which is why I wasn't that. I mean, I was curious, but I was. It doesn't tell me anything. It seems like kind of. Okay, fair enough. There's loads of films called The Haunting. There was another film called The Haunting of that came out this week. It's so familiar. I mean, we've got and there was the what was it? The Mike Flanagan series. I think there was The Haunting there and
Haunting of
stuff.
Bly Manor, the Haunting of
Yeah,
Hill
so
House.
we've seen it so much, and maybe that's what they're trying to do here. Do that, but I think that's to the detriment of the film. I think it was so. To that sense, so maybe that is what's gone wrong here. I think it's a really well-made film. Okay, it's not perfect. It's got some flaws or whatever, but I was, really drawn into it.
I
For
was
the compositions were fantastic.
on board at the beginning. I think that it opens brilliantly. It's in the midst of a crisis when the film starts, and we got that great sort of like shot going in through the porthole into the, from the exterior interior.
Yes.
And we're following various crew members as they're trying to sort of muster the passengers because something's going on, in the ship itself. I think all that was great, and I wish it had just continued from that point onwards. But no, then we get, oh, a few hours earlier that evening, I thought, oh, now we have to build up to it again, sort of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I hate
Well,
in.
it's got these parallel narratives. It's got flashbacks within those kind of. It's got like flashbacks within flashbacks kind of thing going on, and side things and fantastical scenes and whatever. So that it you could, it's like you say, it's throwing everything at it, isn't it? It's trying every single trick in the book.
I found some of the pacing to be off, which is why I sort of said I found it a bit dull overall. There was one element I did like with the modern captain receiving phone calls telling him, it's almost like there's a conspiracy around the ship, and it's like, yeah, we know there's weird shit happening here, but we're trying to keep a lid on it, that was interesting, I must admit. And as I said, there are some very gory moments along the way,
Yeah, and
and
the bit with the boy in the swimming pool and stuff, that was really intense.
it was, yeah, that's what I mean. I thought, oh, they're really going to go there. I thought that was it. He's done.
Well, that's one of the confusing things, because they never kind of clarify it. You're not actually sure what happened. Is he or isn't he? Kind of thing. It's like one of those things. It's like because
Well,
there's other stuff
especially,
that happens with the character later.
because, well, there's the daughter and the other, in the past as well, and
Yeah,
what happens
which is all to do with the
there.
parallel that's going on. It's like
Indeed.
we've got mother, we've got a family of three and a family of three and a captain of the captain, and they're trying to do these parallel stories, and then let's add in the captains as well. Let's have them sort of going a little bit mad and stuff. And yeah, I think if you do see, I like the captain stuff. I don't think it's necessary. I think the film could have easily done without it, or at least toned it down and just sort of hinted at it rather than developing those bits. But I think it adds to the color and texture of it. But I think if you'd have trimmed that out, you'd have had a more solid focused on the family sort of dynamic kind of, and maybe it's more of a swift hour and a half kind of film. But I'm not sure necessarily I really want that. I quite like its misguided, but it's ambition, let's say, whatever it's like. I quite like that. I mean, they've made this over 2 hours and they've tried to put so much into it, and I'm just pretty I was perplexed by a fair amount of it, but I thought a lot of, there's a bit with the axe murder kind of stuff again. Mm-hmm. It's The Shining. But the axe murder stuff kind of was really intense, really worked really well. There's some interesting stuff with the daughter in the past, and she's interacting with, people like Fred Astaire and stuff, which is really unusual. Which is again the sort of did that actually happen, or is this sort of a fantastical memory, or a dreamlike version of that they're living through? Maybe the ghosts, is that the ghosts experiencing this? This that is not the actual series of events, but that is like a replayed sort of scenario that a cycle that they're stuck in. Who knows? Okay. I don't know. I didn't quite catch what they were getting at with some of that stuff, but I quite like that it was all in there, really. And so I thought the cast did a good job. Alice Eve is really good as always. I think she gets a bit short shrift really with some of the stuff, because she does a lot of really good work, and then it gets these low-key releases and stuff, and so a lot of her stuff just doesn't really get seen. I mean, I might be wrong, but I can't think of the last time one of her films had a big outing, apart from when she was in Star Trek Into Darkness and stuff like that. But I think she's really good.
Indeed. Okay. How are you going to score it?
I'm going to give it another 8, because I really, really enjoyed it. I think the cinematography and the music and stuff worked really well. So I think there's enough here that I would potentially go back and watch it again. So I'm going to say 8.
Okay. I'm going to give this one another 7. Okay. So that's a 7 and an 8 for The Haunting of the Queen Mary. Go check it out. Our next film is End of Term. A group of students are tormented by the lingering menace of Garth Stroman, an artist who had a disturbing vision 50 years prior. The pupils discover that true art can only be achieved through suffering and pain. Interesting framework for this one, Rich, in that it is set up as a police procedural, where the one of the survivors of something that's happened at the school or the student accommodation, and she's being interviewed as to what had happened sort of the nights before. I quite like that setup. I think we've seen it before, but it's a setup I do like. However, it doesn't stick to it, the film portrays events of things which she could not have been party to or aware of, which is kind of where it breaks down for me a bit. There is one incredibly stupid moment which made me just like slap my forehead in disgust and despair. There's a character in the film who's like an art critic, and a much reviled art critic, who's at this this gallery opening, and he's telling everyone what pieces of shit they are, that. And he goes off to the loo, and he's whistling a tune by Mozart. And as he comes out, he hears someone in the distance singing the same tune, and decides to go and investigate. Why? Why would he? Somebody's whistling, I'd better go and find out what they're... No, go back to the party where there's food and drink and people, instead of wandering these... I just couldn't... It just seemed an incredibly contrived moment. There were others peppered throughout the film. I didn't get on with this one particularly well. I maybe it's a case of fatigue. for this kind of film. We had that South African one recently. Again, it's a similar sort of thing. There's a couple of kills which are interesting. It's a whole thing
That
with
was
this.
Rage, wasn't it? It was
Yes,
Rage.
that's it, Rage. In this one of the art students has built this death trap in order to sort of capture the fear in somebody's eyes when they're in the machine. And of course, something goes wrong later on. Of course, it does. I don't know. How did you get on with this one? I will say also, it was great to see Peter Davison. He's having something of a sort of late career resurgence because he turned up in something else recently as well. I can't remember what it is now, off the top of my head, but it is great to sort of see, the Fifth Doctor, back on our screens. I
Still,
think,
still very youthful as well.
it's still very
That's nice.
recognisable as
Yeah.
as Peter Davison, as it were,
Yeah.
which is great. So I was great to see him in this, but yeah, how did you get on with this one, Rich?
I liked it more than I was than I thought I would, really. I thought it was a very it's a slasher movie,
Yeah,
basically.
it is, yeah.
It's a but a very a very good take on it. It's like it didn't feel. I think it was felt about right. It's not got a big budget, but it's it had just enough money, and just made just a good enough standard that it's make that it stood out. The quality was on the higher side. It didn't feel like a it's got quite this kind of contrived sort of setup with the art school and everything, but I thought it worked okay, the obnoxious kids sort of, young people sort of thing. I mean, we watched a short film recently, which was about an art school a girl at art school and sort of losing her mind
Oh,
and
yeah.
stuff happening. And there's a little bit of that in here, that same sort of idea. But essentially, it's like the slasher movie thing, but with that interrogation room sort of framework kind of thing. A bit like all the other films we've talked about today, funnily enough, this is a film that has like some very well-known films as very key touchstones, especially as you get towards the end. I'm like, no, this literally is that movie. It's like, by the time you get to the end, you're like, it's like you've copied it like right down to the thing. It's like, which I think was a bit of a mistake. I mean, it's fine. But I think that made the ending a bit more oh come on kind of thing than it could have been. It sort of undermined the film a bit. I think do all the slasher movie sort of cliches as you like. That doesn't bother me at all. That's fine. That's all part and parcel. But when you're doing stuff that's very much from a particular film that's so sort of ingrained. I think that's a mistake, but great, good. The cast were really solid. The film looked really good. It's clearly quite limited, but as like Rage was and stuff like that, films. It's definitely in that sort of wheel. Sort of in that area of films that are made with very modest budgets, but they really know how to use them. This is the only directing credit of a director called Matt Mononi. This was actually made, I think, in or at least originally
2021.
finished one 2021. So like, it's been sort of lying around a couple of years. I can't see any other work by this person, short films or anything else or anything upcoming. But
It's a good
they seem to
start.
come out of nowhere. They've done a good job.
Yeah.
I can't say they haven't. The writer's got more of a background. John Paul Chappell, who's well been around since the 80s, it seems, doing all sorts of stuff. But the yeah, I think the thing is, it's such a well-worn concept, and everything's so kind of slight about it that there's really nothing much to say.
True.
It's a solidly made slasher movie with some nice, enjoyable supporting performances by recognizable actors like Peter Davison, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, on other than that sort of very contrived moment I talked about, the rest of it, is relatively fine. We don't have anything bad to say about it. It's just that, it's in there. It's in the mix of all the other sort of slasher films. It doesn't really have anything to sort of make it sort of stand out, which in itself isn't a bad thing.
No, I was saying if you like a slasher movie
Yeah,
or a
by all means
detective
rent it
movie,
and
a
you won't be
slasher movie sort of thing,
disappointed.
you won't be disappointed. It's not massively slashery. It's not like there's not apart from that scene you mentioned earlier, and a couple of other bits. There's a bit of gruesome in there, but it's more.
Oh, there's a great decapitation. I
Yeah.
must admit that, that was very, very interesting.
I'll tell you the film that came to mind probably more than any other when I was watching it. It was Valentine,
Okay.
which was the Jamie Blanks
Yeah.
follow-up to Urban Legend. So it kind of had a because the killer in this one has a mask, and it's not quite the same, but but it's not just the masked killer kind of thing. It's just sort of the atmosphere of it kind of made it just made. I might just be reading something into it, whatever, but that was the film out of all the slasher movies. That was the one that sort of came to mind as feeling like it was a touchstone for this. But let's say there's another movie that's not a slasher film, which is an even bigger touchstone, which is just like, oh, which I was just like, oh, come on, don't know when it got to when, by the end of the film. But still, I enjoyed it. It was, exceeded my expectations. A good solid British movie. Well, what, you know, if you enjoy it, if you enjoy horror movies and that, you're not going to be disappointed.
And on
I
that
don't
note,
think. Anyway, I might be wrong, but I don't think so.
Rich, how are you going to score it?
I think it's a solid 7.
Okay. Why not? I'll give it a 7 as well. 2 7s for end of term. Go check it out. Our final main review is Washington Armor, also known as Washington's Armor. This follows the trajectory of George Washington as a boy and a young man as he develops his relationships and his ideals. Actually, skip the boy part. It's join jump straight in as he's a young man. He's an officer in the army. The film starts with him sort of helping out an Indian tribe who's sort of like being converted from working with the French and using very sort of brutal tactics, and he's a bit sort of put off by it all. There's a war with France looming, and he is very key to try and raise troops for Ohio in order to sort of defend the state, because otherwise the French are coming. It's pretty well done overall. This there is sufficient budget to make it go, oh cool. All the period dress looks good, all the uniforms, all of that seems authentic. There are some pretty decent there's a decent sized cast of extras for things like a ballroom scene, which is all very well done. He doesn't have a lot of men, admittedly. I think he's only got about 50 men at any one time. But I did enjoy this overall. It wasn't too po-faced. It wasn't there was plenty of incident going on to sort of keep you interested. It sort of takes you up to a particular battle, sort of particular famous battle that he participated in. And sort of leads from there. We get introduced to Martha, at one stage as well. And the sort of the way the film is written, the sort of the dialogue is in keeping with the sort of style that people talked to, or at least the sort of the gentry talked at the time. It's sort of sometimes it is a bit difficult to follow. You're sort of looking at the subtitles, and of course the internet generated subtitles are a joke. I don't know if you've ever sort of had them on, but they try to print phonetically Sort of listening to what people are saying, and oh, it's a mess sometimes. It's quite amusing. But overall, I thought, as a this wasn't too bad. It's still pre pre the War of Independence. That's a way off, basically. So, but even so, we're talking about a guy who is, his whole life was very well documented. So there's plenty to sort of historical fact there. It's if you're a history buff, if you're a period history buff, I think you would enjoy this. It's not low budget at all, really. I mean, certain scenes, it is shot on sort of digital, I guess, rather than film, but I think it pulls it off for the most part. Considering that we were like going, should we drop it? I was
Yeah.
kind of glad we didn't in the end.
Are you going to, are you looking forward to volume two?
Yeah, maybe, because there is still a lot to cover. So I imagine volume two would be leading up to the War of Independence, at least. And maybe sort of delve into that. I'd hope they get a bigger budget as well, because they're going to need more people on screen, I
Yeah.
think.
Out of interest, is it, was it presented? How widescreen was it? How did it look? Was
Yeah,
it letterbox, or was it like sort of more full filled
it
the filled your 16 by 9
was
screen?
pretty letterbox, I think.
And does it? And because I get the feeling, or looking at the filmmakers and stuff, that it's made by a Christian filmmaking company. So I'm just wondering, is there any sort of religious elements that are
No,
sort of pressed in on the film?
that didn't really come across
No, okay.
at all.
Because the director previously did a short film about the crucifixion and all that sort of stuff, so
All right.
I was curious whether it was a, because I've watched films like Mormon period films and some really like, and I was like, would, if this was like a similar kind of standard, where they've actually got really good solid production values rather than being a
Yeah,
bit too
production
sort of cheap
values
and
are really good.
cosplayish,
No, production values are really good.
reenactment teams and stuff like that.
So yeah, everything. As I said, the costumes, the sets and everything all look very authentic. I think they must have had good access to sort of various country houses and things to pull it off. But yeah, no, I thought they did it really well. I would give this one a 6 out of 10. So go check it out. Our short shot this week is Lollipop. Rachel is given a week to reevaluate her life and determine if the path she's chosen will truly lead to a life she desires. However, her decision could have unforeseen circumstances. This is an interesting short, Rich. Although it does sort of spin its wheels for quite a while. So, we get this incident at the beginning where Rachel's sort of beaten up and she's given an ultimatum. You've got 7 days. We're not sure what those, so, we can assume what that ultimatum is, But then she spends the next 7 days just doing fuck all, apart from sort of taking her medication and just doing nothing really, except getting text messages going, you've got 6 days, you've got 5 days. It's like, okay. It's nicely edited, and I suppose the idea is that, she's taking this medication, which says don't drink alcohol while you're taking this meds, and she's like, ah, fuck it, I'm taking alcohol with my meds. You're not the boss of me. So we get these sort of interesting time jumps, which are very nicely edited. It's almost as if like Edgar Wright was doing the editing on this. Kind of thing. It's very, very nice transitions from day to day, but then the film sort of wakes up, and we get this great sort of like almost a sort of comedic sort of Tarantino moment or Guy Ritchie moment from Lock, Stock. It's kind of that, with these sort of very inept drug dealers. I thought that was very good. Yeah, and then the ending, we get this. It's kind of that this bittersweet moment where she's chosen to go down one path, but then we sort of like see, it's almost as if there's two doors. She's gone in one, but we can sort of, the second door's open a crack, and we can sort of peek in and kind of see what might have been under door number two, which is a sort of very interesting way of playing things. You curated this one as usual, Rich. What do you got to say for it?
This came to my attention on Film Combat Syndicate. Mike Garcia wrote an article, a review on the film, which I hadn't heard of. So that's where I found the link to it. It's made by Raison Media Productions director Jared Miller. It's about 20 minutes long. I think you're right. I think it's kind of it's stylishly made, and it's when are we going to get to the fireworks factory, as you would say.
Indeed.
The But I think there's stuff you can sort of interpret about, it seems like, well, it's all about what you interpret in terms of what you think's actually happening. But so you get the original setup, and then yeah, there's this kind of, she's set up, the character is introduced as very sort of, devil may care is not quite the right, but she just, she's very selfish and, doesn't really care.
She's burned bridges, basically.
Yeah, she's not a great, she's not a good person, basically. They make that quite clear. And it's almost like, so my interpretation of what was happening was, she's got to, sort something out, and she's just watching the days go by, because she just doesn't care. She's just like waiting for it to come. She's just like, I'm not even gonna try. She's just like, oh, I'm not even gonna bother. It's just
I
like, yeah,
think,
you keep saying what's going to happen or whatever, I don't care. But then when it gets to, say, the latter part, when it really sort of gets into gear, and you get a nice, some action and stuff starts happening, and and then we get to the conclusion of the film, where the sort of rug gets pulled out from under you in quite a clever way, I think. I think that's what sold it for me. It is like, say, stylish. The characterization is quite interesting. The action's solid, and it's got a very cool twist of, it was right there from the start, but you just didn't see it. Kind of, it's quite clever.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, yeah, I mean, I think you're right in that her attitude is like, I'm just gonna do what I do. But at the same time, I think, when she reaches out to her friend, I think it's sort of, I think she's also battling with her own, indecision up to that point. So, she's not. She can't decide between which way to go, so she does reach out to a friend
Well,
to
that's
sort
the you can't make her completely irredeemable.
of.
That's the thing about, having a sort of a not anti-hero, but sort of a curmudgeonly character, or whatever it is, sort of a moody character, or a bleak, unappealing character. You've got to put like an inkling there. You've got to put something that says, I've got to get on your side for something. It's like you've got to see something in that character, not just all then the negative. So you could, so yeah, there's you're hoping that, you're seeing that she's got the potential, that she could potentially make a correct decision, but then actually she's probably going to do it. Well, you'll see when you watch the film.
Indeed. Okay, so we don't score the shorts, but we do recommend you go check them out. And you will find a link to this in the footnotes below. Go check it out. Our DTV throwback this week is Ballistic. Badass cop Jessie Gavin finds herself battling her misogynist team members as much as the scum on the streets. Can we get more 80s than this, Rich?
Or mid-90s.
Or mid-90s even. Can we get more VHS era straight to video thriller than this? I
It's got it
really,
all, I
really
think. It's got every
it's
single
yeah.
convention of the period, I think.
I think it has. Great cast as well. So some
Amazing
very
cast.
some great familiar faces in this one. I like the start. We again, like the film we talked about last week, it sort of throws in a kind of a bit of TNA right at the beginning. And then it's like, hey, baby, I got to go to work. And then, she goes out as a streetwalker. It's like, okay. Very interesting opening. We've got the likes of Sam Jones in this. I thought he was great. Nice to have him without his voice being dubbed. The first half of this is just so misogynistic. It really is. If it wasn't for the fact that we're taking everything from her point of view, this would be, a bit of a red flag film. It really would. There's a great bit where Sam Jones is screwing his secretary, and she says, "Oh, sure thing, Rick." And he goes, "We're not fucking anymore, so it's back to Mister." Sort of things like that.
Andrew Tate would be proud.
He would be proud. He really would. The whole bit, where she goes on this bus, it turns out, she's an undercover cop, and her backup is nowhere to be seen. And then afterwards, they're bitching about her, saying, "Oh, she didn't even check her microphone to see if it was working," and all that, but it's like as soon as she starts talking to them, the condescending attitude is like, "Hey, sweet cheeks, hey, honey," all this sort of shit. It's like, oh God, I mean, how is she's not punching them in the face and kicking them in the balls, is beyond me. It is very amusing, and of course, we've got a certain Michael Jai White in this.
Now, did you know he was in it?
I didn't know he was in it
Did you
before.
go, hang on a minute, that's Michael Jai White?
Well, the funny what happened was, I was watching it, and I'm thinking, this guy is basically got his own movie within a movie, because so much time is spent on Michael Jai White's character doing these fights. It's almost like he's in a, blood sport tournament slash Lionheart kind of scenario. And it took me a while to realize, hang on a minute, that is it's Michael Jai White, and he's credited as just Michael White, but it's definitely him. So I was really impressed that he was getting, so much screen time for, kickboxer number one kind of thing. I thought he was really good. I mean, the fight scenes are. If you compare the fight scenes between this and Fist of the Condor, there is quite a difference. But at the same time, they're pretty acrobatic. There's some really good sort of spin kicks and jumping kicks, things going on on in this. Some
Well, a
good
bit like
throws.
Marco Giroud, like we were saying,
Yeah.
like when he hit that guy and he flew across the room. Michael Jai White does one of his really sort of powerful signature kicks and just
There's,
kicks a guy
yeah.
across the room.
There's a lot of cardboard boxes to be
Cardboard box. It's a very
yeah,
cardboard box movie, yeah.
it's a very cardboard box movie, but I did enjoy this. Yeah, as I said, our heroine is having to battle people's attitudes. The cop she's with, who is supposed to be looking after this witness, and she comes out of the bathroom and he's fucked off, and she's like, oh right, okay, something's going down. And then he just strolls back in later on as if nothing had happened. It's like, you sent me away. That was it's just weird. The audacity of some of it is great. It really is. Richard Roundtree is in this, of course.
Yep.
Very good. Overall, it's just a very solid. Lots of action, lots of good stuff going on. Thoroughly enjoyable. We get a great moment of Chekhov's gun, or Chekhov's rocket launcher in this
Yeah.
case. You
Another
can't,
very prevalent
yeah,
trope of the period.
you can't show us a rocket launcher and not use it. That's just not done, and this doesn't disappoint. So yeah, I was totally on board with this one. I hadn't heard of it before. I hadn't seen it before. But I thought it worked.
Yeah, I've been wanting to see it for years. I don't know if it ever had a proper UK release, so this version we found is on YouTube. One of the one of there's a number of people on YouTube who it's piracy as archive,
Yeah.
preservation, piracy as preservation.
Yeah.
So all
God,
these films that
this
you
was
just
taken
can't
from a
find
laser
anymore.
disc as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a laser disc. Yeah. Which is why I think there's that bit in the middle or about in the middle where the film just like slight goes pause, black for like a few minutes, or not a few minutes, but you know, like I don't know, a minute or something. It's like I think they were changing discs or something, and that must be what happened. But yeah, so it's pretty good. I'm coming at it with I'd wanted to see it for a really long time. Was it going to live up to my expectation? It's very much of the time. So we've got a female hero played by Margeen Holden, and she doesn't get to carry the film as much as you would hope she would. Kind of an issue with the female led action of the time anyway. A lot of the stuff would still defer to males. Stars, you know, that there are a few that, like, you know, Cynthia Rothrock made a few where she was very much the focus, but then there were others where they sort of leveraged her and sort of went off and followed some other characters. And that's what happens here, is they surround her with all these other characters, and then they go and like say, oh no honey, you go off and do that, we're gonna do that, especially in the second half where Richard Roundtree sort of basically becomes the main star, and she's off, you know, investigating, and then it's her and it's Richard Roundtree and her boyfriend, and we're essentially following them for the most of the time, and then it sort of they go and find her at the end, and then she gets to have the sort of final have one of the climactic fight scenes and stuff. So she's good in what she gets to do, but then she'd say the film sort of keeps pulling away to go and do other things. It also says, well, you've got to be in the shower first time we see you, and you've got to have a love scene. And all this sort of stuff. So she, you know, it's made, you don't see that in quite the same way today, but we watched Killshot a couple of weeks ago, which shows that although you don't get maybe the same level of nudity and stuff, some things are still not quite changed, you know, not that that's always a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's, you know, guys want to see girls and you know, whatever, and sometimes girls want to see boys or whatever it is, and but it is very shoehorned in, sort of a bit sleazy kind of stuff, but that's kind of what they did during this period, as this is the period of erotic thrillers and stuff, so they're channeling that as well, which
I think
is
things what... like, you know, Fair Game, the one with Cindy Crawford.
Yeah, that would have been around the same time as this.
There's a funny moment in this. We got Charles Napier playing the police captain.
I think he's played the captain in loads of films. Yeah, I love Charles Napier.
He is great. Yeah. And there's a scene at the end where he suddenly just shoots somebody. You know, there's a guy sort of going, "I'm out. I'm not dealing with this anymore. You know, I'm saving myself."
Yeah, yeah.
And he walks off and he gets shot in the back. And I thought it would be amazing if it turns out that he's not dirty.
Because I was just like, hang on a minute. And the line he says is like, I hate, you know, basically, without giving it all, you know. There's only one thing worse than a dirty
cop is a coward, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I'm thinking, well,
does that mean?
Aren't you a dirty cop? It's like, but if he's not, so I was thinking, well, the fact that he said that, maybe he's not a dirty cop.
Maybe he's not a dirty cop, just murdered someone.
I kind of thought that about Margeen Holden's character. I mean, I know heroes normally do kill people in there, but she basically like snaps necks she didn't really need to. It's just like, it's like procedural detective trying to take down the drug dealer kind of stuff, but then it's got all this punch fighter padding where they've got Sam Jones is running these illegal fights, so that's sort of like shoehorns in some extra actions scenes and stuff, and that's where Michael Jai White's character, who's actually got a name, he's Quint.
Yeah, Quint, yeah.
Who's got more screen time than I thought he was going to have, and he has a fight with Nils Allen Stewart, which is pretty cool. I love those, I love both those guys, so that's cool to see them at. And the funny thing is, they have the fight, and you think Nils Allen Stewart's won.
Yeah.
Because it looks like he's broken Michael Jai White's back. And then Michael Jai White gets up and they fight for another few minutes.
Yeah. Well, there's a little nod and a wink, isn't there, between him and Sam Jones' character.
Uh-huh.
It's like just...
Yeah, he's almost like... He's not quite henchman, number one, but he's close because he does get a couple of other scenes. You know, I don't know whether they watched him. So actually, we're going to put you in this next scene where you're going to do like this flip And then you're going to sort of square off to sort of face down with this other, you know, the boyfriend character and stuff, which is where the film goes off in those other directions and that. But
I
they've
did
got
like
this.
that bit, you know, where he
Yeah.
gets caught. Is it when he gets caught snooping? They go, "Oh, you're here for an audition, right? Okay."
Yeah,
You know, he's
yeah.
like, "Oh, fucking hell, right? Okay."
So
So,
they shoehorn in another fight scene.
another fight scene, that's it.
And yeah, so that so we got then we've also got Vince Clynne, who's a guy, or Vince or Vincent Clynne, who was in Cyborg and loads of other stuff. Very recognizable. I think he was in Point Break as well. He's in here as again one of the, sort of, you could almost call him henchman number one, because he's what no, he's lingering. He doesn't get to do really much of the fight scenes as much as Michael Jai White, but he is around sort of threateningly quite a lot. We've got James Liu as the cop, who's disparaging
One
Jesse,
of the
Nadine
two,
Holden's character, and he's actually good, because you know, James Liu quite often cast in sort of small roles or as like baddies and not much dialogue and stuff, and here he's actually, you know, not a complex character, but not the character, you know, more of a character than we usually get to see him play. He's got some, you know, dialogue, and you know, you're not quite, you know, he gets to be a character. You know, he's a bit of a scumbag and stuff. And so, and he's the choreographer of the action. He's the stunt coordinator and fight coordinator on the film. So he brings a lot to it, I think. And also, you've got, say, we've already mentioned Richard Roundtree. There's a few other people in the cast, like Robert Miano turns up and stuff. But the other thing I want to mention, apart from the cast that's notable and the choreographer, is that the composer of the film is Tyler Bates, who's gone on to, you know, John Wick and all that sort of stuff. He's like one of the go-to guys in Hollywood now, but from composing films. And yeah, I didn't realize his career went back this far. So that was really interesting to see his name turn up on the credits. I'm not sure where this actually. I'm gonna have a quick look where this sits. He'd only been composing for a couple of years, or at least on films. He's got two other credits before this, which is also known as Fist of Justice, by the way. If you ever try to look it up on IMDb, it's under Fist of Justice with the poster for Ballistic. But yeah, he was in DTV land until Get Carter, basically, which was still essentially DTV, but that was the Stallone movie that he did quite a good score, or, you know, reworking of the old rework the classic scores, I think, and brought some of his own stuff to it, but then went on to, you know, he bided Half Past Dead, the Steven Seagal movie, and I think it's kind of films like The Devil's Rejects, where he sort of, big, you know, sort of crossed over into getting bigger work, and then, you know, 300 and stuff. So Doomsday, all sorts of stuff. You know, he's in much demand these days. So that's really cool to go back and sort of discover that. It's not, I wouldn't say this is a particularly good movie or a great movie or anything, but I
No.
will say it's got lots of composite, you know, it's got lots of elements that we enjoy. You know, the casting's great. It's got the you know, the obligatory rocket launcher. There's no sort of there's a bit of a car chase, but it's not an amazing one. It's
No.
not quite PM, but it's
That's what
basically
I
got a
was about
lot
to
of the
say. If
constitute elements of a PM entertainment film. Even Sam Jones, who was in a lot of P he was in PM stuff himself, makes you feel, was this made by PM? Well, no, it wasn't, but it does definitely
there's
have that
only one
look and feel of
explosion. There's only one
it.
explosion mentioned. Of course, it wasn't PM. But yeah, I think that's what would have made it a great movie. Is if you know, if this had been under the PM entertainment banner, that'd been great. But as it is, it's solid enough. You know, it has these sort of interesting elements. It's the whole sort of you know, the misogynist attitude and everything. It's you know, villains that you just love to hate, basically. It's a lot going on.
The real henchman of the movie is actually a henchwoman. It's Claudia, played by
And
Carina
she's
Everson.
very good as well.
So she's the one who gets to have sort of the big showdown
She has a
with
couple of good
Nadine
little
Holden.
scenes.
Yeah,
She's
she does.
like the
Yeah.
what she's like the white version of Joyce Kadenzi, Sammo Hung's wife, because she I think that's the one I'm thinking of. She
Oh,
used to be a
what, from
bodybuilder.
She Shoots Straight? Yeah.
So she, you know, she's got that going for her, sort of, you know, sort of deadlifting the bad guys over her head and stuff. All good stuff.
Yeah, well, there's this one bit actually where she throws this guy in one of the earlier scenes. It's a really good stunt bit where she, I think, she chucks him over a, it's like a sofa or something. It's like a, I thought that was a really good bit of stunt work there between them both. And yeah, and I think the fights are well choreographed, and say as unnecessary as a lot of it is, I enjoyed it. And I, you know, Richard Roundtree, you know, he can make, you know, he can, you know, spin out a, you know, he brings this shot, his, you know, his charm, you know, that he's, you know, from, you know, that, you know, is what made his, him famous in films like Shaft and stuff. That's all there. You know, he brings a lot to it, playing this, he's played that character or variations of that character in loads of different stuff. And I you know, it's a bit, it might, maybe it's a bit one note, but it just, it works for me. I thought he was really good. Same as Charles Napier. He's always the same, essentially. If there's very little variation. Sam Jones is, sometimes he's a hero, sometimes he's a villain. He's one of those guys who can sort of move between the two, but I thought he does play a really good villain. And really, you know, the sort of the star card, you know, the sort of the main reason to see it is, you know, that appearance by Michael Jai White, because, you know, I think they knew what they had with him.
Oh yeah,
and that's what I think they probably brought him in for like one scene, and maybe said, "Actually, we've got to do more with this guy."
Yeah, let's keep him around. Yeah, exactly.
Because he was sort of spinning. He was doing, I think, like a lot of films of this type. He'd started out. He worked in, you know, DTV movies, low budget movies, for quite a long time before like breaking out in Spawn and stuff like that. Which was, you know, Spawn was only like, what, 2 years after this.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So
cool. Well, we don't score the throwbacks, but we do recommend you go check them out. This is a lot of fun. We'll put a link to the version we found on YouTube in the footnotes below. Go check it out. And that is the end of this week's show. As you had noticed, Steve isn't with us this week. He's off on his holes. So thanks to Rich for watching these films with us, with me even. Fist of the Condor is my film of the week, I have to say. It's most likely going to be in my top 10 at the end of the year. I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, No One Will Save You was pretty decent. I disagree with the other two a little bit.
Yeah, I think The Haunting of the Queen Mary was possibly my favourite of the week. And that was a controversial choice.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I didn't see that coming. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Twitter at the DTV Digest. Also, check out the Short Shots, where we put a link to a new short every evening around about 8 o'clock. Other than that, thanks for listening. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.